This is the Dave Durant Show with Dave Durant. Welcome to the Dave Durant Show, where faith and the workplace meet. We discuss the tips, tools, and resources to help you become a better leader in the workplace, in your business, and in your home. And as always, I'm joined by our host, Dave Durant. As always, stick around for some listener Q&A where you get to ask the questions and Dave will answer them. Send those questions over to dave@leadinggiants.com. Now, Dave, you delivered a powerful speech at Ave Maria University this past week to a group of students and faculty. So we'll get a chance to play segments of that here this week and next week. But before we get into that, Dave, I had a question for you. What are the four things that make you or I or anyone listening unfireable?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things I've mentioned this before, but the number one thing that most people are worried about at their job is how they're being perceived. Do people know that I'm doing a good job? Am I doing a good job? Sometimes they don't even know. That's why I always make fun of annual reviews. I'm like, listen, if you have an annual review and you sit down with the person your annual review is with and you or them are shocked by what's about to be said, you're so far behind in effective leadership. So to be unfireable is to basically know that you are doing such a fantastic job. There's no way they'd want to get rid of you. Now, there's no doubt about it. There are circumstances that sometimes are bigger than that, like company cutbacks. Now, you're protecting yourself, even in company cutbacks, to be unfireable, so to speak, because they're going to say, well, who can we dispense with and not have it be that big of a deal? Who's expendable and then who is not? But even then it can happen. So I don't want anybody who's been fired to have some sort of complex believing that they have somehow had it always merited. Although, sadly, most often it is. Okay, I'm going to go, Nico, in ascending order, okay, on right. These four. There are other things that, of course, you could put on this list, but these go, to the most important. When I get to number one, it is absolutely by far the biggest thing a person can do to become unfireable. But number four is open communication. A lot of times people say that all the issues are communication issues. That's not necessarily true, but it is true that a person that does fantastic work, but somehow is such a bad self-advocate or communicator, they can block what is known about the outcomes. But what I would say is this, though, that open communication is a little bit different than good communication. You could openly communicate poorly, okay, or you could close off communication even though you're a good communicator. Open communication basically means the necessary transfer of information that needs to take place between you and others and different departments is flowing. That you're not cutting off email by not responding to it at certain times. You're not unavailable or not answering your phone. There are times where you have questions, you need something, that you're reaching out. You're not postponing those things. But there's an open flow of communication. Now, some people do this differently. Some people say that I have a required meeting that has to happen every single week with a particular person. And I'm a fan of that. Actually, there are some times that I do that with particular people. But mostly what I do is routine short check-ins. I think that mastering the 1 minute conversation is one of the most important things that we could possibly do. Which means, hey, I'm just checking in, just seeing if you need anything from me. Here's what's going on in my day. Super quick communication. That usually alleviates the need for something bigger later on. Hey, there's something I was wondering if you could look at, go to the back office. I noticed these statistics. Maybe you could tell me more about them later. Do you want to catch up? Something like that, whatever it happens to be. So keeping a short, level of communication frequently or a longer thing once a week, whatever it happens to be. There's no exact formula on that. In fact, I did it very differently than the CEO who I promoted to take over my spot when I moved into executive chairman. He has routine meetings every single week with everybody important in the organization. And I just kept frequent contact with them all the time and had only those meetings with people like the CFO and whatnot. In fact, I had those meetings scheduled with the CFO. And when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue and business and all sorts of people, having an important meeting with your CFO matters. But what I found is that we communicated so often in the random open sense with my door open, his door open, that by the time we got to our monthly meetings to review the P&Ls and all the other financial statements, I was like, okay, yep, looks good. Nothing shocking here. And we oftentimes didn't even have really a full deep dive. And it wasn't that we didn't cover those things. They were just covered throughout the month routinely. The guy that I promoted is a fantastic CEO. He does it differently. Now, here's an interesting thing. probably half of the people on his team are so happy he does it that way. That is the way they operate. And the other half are like, yeah, I don't need this. Kind of like the spontaneous thing. I don't know. I never asked them, by the way. Okay. But I'm assuming, because I do know that about half the people that I worked with were like, hey, can we have a specific routine meeting? In which case I was more inclined to actually provide that to them. Others are like, well, I'm so glad we do it this way. So, you know, but again, I wouldn't get hung up. I don't think that you have to customize that to each particular person. You as the leader can determine whether or not you're more effective with just the regular routine meeting or just often check-ins. But just make sure you're not missing anyone. That's the biggest thing. That's open communication.
Yeah, great, Dave. I think I would probably err on the side of doing routine meetings myself. But I do like the spontaneity of knowing that, hey, we can just chat about this and the door's wide open and you can do it in 1 minute and that's it.
Yeah, and that preferential thing matters. I do want to say that because some people would look at this as though it's right and wrong. What is right is that the leader, the person in charge of this communicating, if it is a top-down thing versus bottom-up, It does it the way they're most effective. Okay. Now, what's really funny, though, is that the leader is working with somebody else who says, just so you know, I am not effective with the just check-ins like this. I need a weekly meeting like this. And you're going to claim that you're more effective as a leader by forcing them to do something that they find ineffective. Now you've got an ego problem. There is a time to customize it to the other person. But generally speaking, you take what makes you the most effective as a leader and you apply that to the circumstance. And then you make those individual catered changes according to the person that you're leading. And that's absolutely a smart way to do it. It's a prudential way to do it.
It reminds me of a post you had a while back on leading with empathy. Mm. That's the empathetic approach, in my opinion. But moving to the next point here on the four things that make you unfireable. What is that next point?
Make things better. There's this kind of classic saying that to be a good steward, you want to leave things in better shape than you found them. You know, whether they're your own or they're not your own, you know, if you make a mess, clean it up. You know, if you borrow someone's car, return it in great shape. You're even better to fill the gas tank up if you borrow somebody's car and to vacuum it out as a token of gratitude, even if it wasn't presented to you that way. In your own role, it's the same thing, to make your role better. And some people become a little bit too overreaching with this sort of thing, and they try to step into other areas, departments that are not their own because they are acting as though they have the solution to all things to make everything better. You don't want to go too far outside of your lane on this sort of thing because you can have something be counterintuitive or counter-effective. But in your own role, it's important to say, here are the responsibilities that I have. Here's how I can organize it better. Here's a checklist that I can use on a daily basis. Here's a technology that I think we could use. Let me see if I can advocate for getting that technology in order to make this better. Now, sometimes that's going to mean you're going to interact or integrate with other departments as well, too. Now, there's that professional level of, prowess that you would need in order to effectively win people over to coordinate things in departments, to keep silos from taking place and turf wars. But those things are a little bit of a slower bake sometimes, and that's okay. But definitely just saying, hey, from the time that I got this job to now, did I actually make it better? And for the person who takes it over for me, did I leave them with a little bit of a simpler user manual that makes things better? This is a great way to get a promotion, by the way, is to always leave things in a better circumstance than you found them.
Now, that's a solid insight, Dave. What is a number three, I guess, in this list of four things that make you unfireable?
So there's something called a 360 survey out there. It's been around for a while. This is not new, but that's basically where you have your boss do a confidential anonymous survey about what it's like to work with you. Your peers do the same thing. And if there are subordinates, your subordinates do it. So you basically have all of these people talking behind your back, telling you exactly what you think they think of you in a confidential way in order to super elevate your intense paranoia for the rest of your career. I say that because they have backfired for that reason with many people. But really, there is something about knowing what you're providing to each one of those 360, degrees that you're going around. Okay. Are you adding value to your boss? You know, is their job better because you're on the team? That's a big deal. Or are you creating problems? Your peers, would they go home and they say, you know, one of the things I loved about the culture is Nico. Nico is like the man. And anytime I need something, he handles it and takes care of it. Your subordinates, do they say, I love working with this particular person? They empower me. They give me the resources, the tools, and the authority that I need to get something done. And therefore, I feel great here. So if you add value to your boss, your peers, and your subordinates, while you have open communication and you make things better, you are virtually unfireable, but there's one missing component.
Well, take notes for those of you who are listening. This is definitely the masterclass and a great masterclass at that on the four things that make you unfireable. So let's get to the number one thing that makes you unfireable, Dave. What is it?
Accepting the full responsibility for your role, including your mistakes. There is no doubt about it. This is what it is. If you say that's not in my job description, well, you know what? Job descriptions, generally speaking, don't include every single thing in there because it's impossible. Okay. If you are a finger pointer, that's not our fault. It's their fault. If you lie or deceive, if you have the agenda of basically ambition, meaning that you're trying to advance yourself, which there's nothing wrong with wanting to advance, but it's an ambitious thing, which means that it's out of order. You want something without meriting it. These are all things that run counter to accepting responsibility for what's taking place. You know, how do you expect me to? You know, I can't ever if. Now, in reality, there are times where there are very bad bosses out there that want you to, you know, make the bricks without being able to provide the hay. Okay. We know that that's unjust circumstance, which sometimes is intended to make things harder because it's a passive aggressive boss. What a sad thing. I'm not talking about that circumstance. That's the time you just leave. Okay. But if you're a person who is honest and humble and you're actually accurately assessing the circumstance, you would know, you know what? I actually do have everything that I need here to succeed. I do have everything here that I need to accept responsibility. And so therefore I need to do that. So there are some virtues that go throughout all of this in order to have open communications, make things better, add value to your boss, accept full responsibility. You need to be prudent, just, you have to have fortitude, you need to have temperance, the cardinal virtues, which I rep out constantly. But you also have to have humility, which of course is a part of fortitude, really. And you have to have magnanimity, meaning that you just refuse to be petty. Okay. And there's more to it than that. But whenever I try to explain magnanimity to people, that is the way they understand it the best, by knowing what it's not. Okay. But when you have these things, now you can accept full responsibility. And that humility is the thing that allows you to say, there was a mistake made here under my watch in what we're doing, and we're going to own that. And I think if people knew the power of owning a mistake and then correcting it, how that actually fortifies the bond and fortifies your status in an organization, because now people don't wonder what would happen if that person made a mistake. Would they hide it? Would they own it? Would they correct it? And if you are owning it and correcting it, you become even more unfireable because there's a certain level of predictability about your behaviors that actually matter. Now, we know that if you're making massive, huge mistakes on a regular basis, it doesn't matter how often you own them. You have a certain level of incompetency that would not allow you to remain unfireable. But these are the things: open communication, making things better, adding value to your boss, your peers, your subordinates, and accepting the full responsibility for your role, including mistakes. If you do that, you can be a giant. We can go slay dragons, and you will be unfireable.
Thank you for sharing, Dave. I think there was a great post that you posted on LinkedIn not too long ago. And by the way, if you guys aren't following Dave on LinkedIn, I highly encourage you to check him out. He posts pretty much every day. And one of the posts that you had was, virtue is the key to long-term sustainable success. And it just reminded me that last point, because you can experience success, as you said, without it, but you cannot keep it.
Yeah.
Wow. Powerful.
Yeah.
All right. So that is the four things that make you unfireable here on the Dave Duran Show. We'll be right back with the Dave Duran Show here after these short messages.
We'll be right back.
This is the Dave Durant Show with Dave Durant.
Welcome back to the Dave Durant Show. Dave, we have a special segment here for the audiences.
Yeah, this is the first part of a presentation that I did for Ave Maria students and faculty. And the title was Win the World Without Losing Your Soul. And I basically was sharing with the students and the faculty that life is an adventure and we need to accept that adventure. And that's why I wore one of the, our logo here. We have so many different sayings that are related to this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But let's go slay some dragons. We're always saying that because life is an adventure. And if you accept it as an adventure, you stop complaining about dragons coming at you. And you realize that, you know what? There's something about this. You know, if you said, hey, let's today wake up and go be like incredibly average and medium or underperforming, that's not nearly as exciting as saying, let's go slay some dragons. So there's that. But at the same time, what is it you're trying to do? And is there a conflict? Does there have to be the idea that two good things, maximizing who you are on earth, doing great things in a big way, does that have to come against what it means to be a saint? Or do these things work together? And they absolutely work together. And so hopefully you enjoy it.
Now, I normally wear a suit when I give a particular speech. At a university, sometimes it's kind of nice. You can go a little bit more casual. But I have this on for a reason, this particular T-shirt. It says, let's go slay some dragons. The company that I've recently founded is called Leading Giants. And at the end of every presentation, I say, and if you do that, you can be a giant and we can go slay some dragons together. It just kind of came out one day. Okay, what happened was the enthusiasm for slaying dragons became very, very clear to me that people have this intense desire, men and women, but mostly it was the guys who are like, yeah, I want to slay some dragons. Why? Because they've been told this is not really what they should do anymore. And they should just kind of sit on the sidelines and not do that. So this is it's a symbol for this talk, win the world and save your soul. One of my books is called Win the World Without Losing Your Soul. Now, the reason that this message is so important, particularly for good people like you students at Ave Maria, and I don't want to over canonize people just because they're affiliated with a particular university, but by far, without question, the collective virtue and humility and holiness in Ave students is really exceptional. It truly is. And one of the signs of that is that the confession lines are long, which means that you're not yet perfect. Which is also good, okay? But one of the things that I see way too often is people making a choice between one of two things. Should I live a holy life or should I go be successful? This is an utterly ridiculous question because the two of these are contingent upon each other. To be ultimately a saint is to be successful. There is no greater success than to become a saint. That is the greatest success. How do you do that? I have six kids. My seventh grandchild is on the way, okay? And they're all in the house. John Paul, some of you know John Paul. He's John, Johnny, whatever. We call him so many different things because he's the youngest in the house. Hey, you. Okay. But he goes here now. He's the youngest. He's 20 years old. So, but I remember saying to my kids when they were young, and my oldest is going to be ordained a priest in May, but I remember saying to them, do you think I want you to be a priest to the boys? And one of them said, yes. And I said, no. I said, I want you to be what God is calling you to be. And if that is a priest, I absolutely want you to hear that call. But if that is a teacher or a business executive or an engineer or a plumber, I want you to hear that call. There's nothing worse than somebody who, on their own accord, has the ambition for the priesthood, but is not called for it. Likewise, there's nothing worse than somebody that has a calling to the priesthood to have the ambition to go build a big business. Now, by the way, do you think I want you to be rich or I want you to be poor? Okay, I don't have a choice there. I want you to be what path is supposed to get you to heaven. My oldest is going to be ordained a priest. My daughter is a stay-at-home mom. She has her four children. My other son is a journeyman electrician. I have a nurse. We almost sound like a Northeast family. If we need a cop and nanny, everything be all right, you know. So then a nurse, and then I've got a son who's graduated from Madison. He's going to be in business. He's a little bit of a chip off the old block. And then John Paul, who will also be in business. The idea, though, was not to be attached to anything other than hearing God's voice. And then entering into that. Now, here's a really also interesting thing. And I'm going to be doing some actual coaching and training with priests, too. One of the things that people also confuse is the difference between Christian leadership and regular leadership. There is none. There is none. So even though I'm setting this up and I'm talking about sanctity, I'm talking about holiness, I'm talking about becoming a saint, if I went into AT&T or IBM or anything else, and I started talking from this point forward in the speech, that all applies there. In my own company, which is a pretty decent-sized business, we have 1,200 magazines in every single state and province in North America, and 25 million readers. We're the largest. We've produced more magazines than any company in world history. And when we first started it, I remember just on a whim, when we had our national conference, which was like 20 people, thankfully, because I invited my family, and my son Ethan, ran the sound system there. But I remember trying to establish credibility for these people who were coming into town while we were super young and trying to establish this credibility with not much going on and tiny little revenues. And I remember thinking, well, you know, we've got some pretty decent things. If we were a newspaper, how big would we be compared to other newspapers, even though we're in a newspaper, but it was in print. And I was like, you know what? We'd be the 140th largest newspaper. So every single year at our conference, which is called SLC, our Strategic Leadership Conference, we would say, this is where we'd be now. And we watched it go to 90, to this, to like 3, to bigger than the USA, and bigger than New York Times, bigger than both of them combined, not even close at this point right now, with what we're producing. And what was that like to go through that process there? The things we talk about in that company, which, by the way, is a radically diverse organization, and I would even say to people, what do you notice in an orientation? And they would go, it's very diverse. And I'd say, yes, do you know why our organization is diverse? And they were like, why? I said, because we don't care at all about diversity. And they were like, whoa, this is a little bit politically incorrect. And I was like, just buckle up for this. Why? Here's the reason why we don't do any of the DEI stuff here. Because there's only one reason any of you are here. One. It's because we think you're going to be the best at it. That's why. You are here for one reason. We perceive you as excellent, and we believe you are going to be excellent at this. Everybody's had this breath of relief. It was fantastic, too. What you have to do is stand for something if this is going to work. What do I want you to do? I want you to go conquer the world. Some people ask me, Dave, why are you doing what you're doing? Because that could be done. I could be done. Because I want to hear, well done, good and faithful servant. I do not want to hear that I buried a single talent. The world can get scary. The world can be unfair. Business is unfair, and it's hard. And that's why I love it. Because if you can navigate that, if you can see it, if you can make good things happen in the midst of it, all great things can happen for you. Do not think small. Don't think small. Think extreme. Some people go, oh, don't be so extreme. Was Jesus extreme? Were the apostles extreme? Was St. Therese extreme? I want you to name the person in history who people remember who wasn't extreme, besides Neville Chamberlain, who is remembered because he wasn't extreme, and look what could have happened, right? But Winston Churchill is the one who's quoted because you want to do something right, and he was extreme. Extreme matters. I want you to think about how extremely great can you be at what you do. We do know there's a problem with vanity, there's a problem with pride, there's a problem with arrogance in the world, but that's not what I see mostly when I see people in business. And I'm going to turn this to business and leadership. If you're not in business, you're going to be a nurse, or you're going to be a politician, you're going to be a teacher, whatever it is you're going to be, it doesn't matter. You can use my business examples as a metaphor for virtually everything else. Why? Because leadership is the same no matter where you go. And no matter what you do. But the idea here is that when I do see people who fail to open a business or be an entrepreneur, it is generally speaking because not because of arrogance and pride, although that's a part of it. It's because they don't know what gifts they have. See, a lot of people act arrogant and prideful. And the reason they're doing it is because they have so little confidence that they make themselves bigger than they need to be when they should actually have confidence. The way God made you is unbelievable what he has done in and for you. So don't you like it? You're in college, somebody says, oh, you have potential. You're like, oh, thank you. I have potential. It feels so good. There is a point in life where that goes from the definition of potential is unused ability. There is a point in life where that goes from being a compliment to quite an insult. And where is that? Where is that line for you? So you don't want to die with unused ability, yet all of us will. But if you lived a perfect life, this is birth, okay? We're going up the graph. We have the X and Y, okay? And you lived a perfect life, never a day of laziness, never a day of not learning when you're supposed to learn. And this would include appropriate vacation, recreation, and breaks, because we are human beings. It included never overeating, but not undereating. It included being in shape the way you're supposed to without being indulgent, but it also didn't mean that you felt like you needed to be the beach body person, become vanity. It's like perfect here. Perfectly holy, perfectly useful, perfect amount of information you should study or not study. You have studiosity, not curiosity, right? So you know the difference, right? Studiosity is good. You're learning for the sake of something good. Curiosity is like pornography for the mind. It's like intellectual pornography. You're just curious about something. And by the way, some people use the word curiosity, and it's fine. I don't get caught up in the denotation and connotation too much because oftentimes they mean studiosity. How does that work? Because if I'm curious, how does that work? Well, really what they're doing is being studious about it. Curious is, you know, top 10 stars of the 80s. Oh, I gotta know. You know, that's clickbait. Okay. So that's the difference between these. So if you live this perfect life, what would that look like? You would die perfectly a saint. Nobody does that. Our lives look more like this. Oh, that was a good year. Oh, I don't want to go look at the low lights there. That was a great year. Yeah. In fact, my conversion, whoop, and what happened after that went right back to that old sin. And we do this, okay? But we have to stay on pace and stay on track with that, which means to galvanize who we are. So I have some simple formulas for this for you to maximize this so you can win the world without losing your soul. First one is this. Realize that the most powerful thing in the world is a decision. And I'm going to come back to that. But every single person is in this room here because of a decision. This building was built because of a decision. You are in Ave Maria because of a decision. You were born because of a decision, which might have been the decision for you to actually be in the world, or maybe not that decision. But for you are here because of decisions. Many of them. It's the most powerful thing in the world. And somebody said, well, isn't God's love more powerful than a decision? Well, what if you reject it? I mean, his love is so powerful that he actually gives us the keys right there to unlock his love is there no matter what. We don't have to unlock that, but to unlock access to the benefits of his love. Okay? So this is a big deal. But I'm going to come back to the decision. The other thing, too, is the key to success is... And when I was a young man, my businesses came off pretty fast. So people were like, hey, what's the key to success? And I was like, I don't know. I was just like, oh, I got action. I'm doing stuff, you know. But I was too vain and too prideful to say, I don't know. So I was like, answer the question. It was like an encyclopedia's length of answer because I figured if I talked long enough, I'd hit it somewhere in there. And the older I got, the more I was like able to narrow it down a little bit. And it went from a full set of encyclopedias to like one book to like one paragraph to one sentence when I was about 40. The key to success is doing what you don't feel like doing. It really is that simple. It's doing what you don't feel like doing. It's the irrefutable key to success. All good things come from this because what is at the core of doing what you don't feel like doing? Virtue. That's at the core of it. Okay, if we're going to accomplish great things in the world, we need to do that. Now, you have been taught and around the idea and concept of virtue more than most people are your age. But I want to really drill them down to make them practical in what you do as you go out there and you conquer something in the world. So the cardinal virtues, and you know, the word cardinal is it's the Latin word for hinge, meaning that all the other virtues hinge upon the cardinal virtues. But the cardinal virtues are not the theological virtues. They're not a religious term. They're, you know, Aristotle talked about them. Many, many philosophers have talked about them over the years. St. Thomas Aquinas did fantastic work really making them fully understood. But they're natural virtues. You don't need to be in the state of grace to experience or to develop these virtues. I love that. Do you know why I love that? Because it answers all sorts of questions. How come this bad person has all these good things happening in their life, but this good person doesn't? Well, because they adhered to the natural virtues. You can be outside of the state of grace and still work hard, can't you? You can be outside of the state of grace and lift weights and sprint and eat right and win awards in sports. You can come up with a creative idea to build something and accomplish it if you're not in the state of grace. Now, would you do better in the state of grace? You absolutely would, because sin makes us stupid, slow, and not as effective. It's just true. It slows up our mind. It does all sorts of things. It clouds our judgment. But God loves us so much that he gives us intense natural abilities. It's a fantastic thing. If you're born 6'5", can you take credit for that? Hey, man, you're tall. Yeah, I did a lot of work on that. No, you can't take any credit for it. You just are. But you know what you can take credit for? What did you do with it? If you were born naturally inclined to art, naturally inclined to math, naturally inclined to, you know, disciplines within the arts, music and whatnot, it's what you do with it that matters. But most people who are really naturally inclined in these sorts of things take offense to people constantly telling them how naturally inclined they are. Oh, you're a natural athlete. That's the reason you're so good at sports. You're like, you have no idea what I have done to go from here to there. Okay. Oh, you know what? Foreign languages just come natural to you, not to me. They're like, are you kidding me? They don't come natural to me. I was in Spain one time and I was looking for a taxi and somebody threw their shoe at my head because of what I said. What are you talking about? So you have these things that you have to get wrong in order to get them right and you suffer through them. But if we have the exceptional. See, you never want to be exceptional this way. There are a lot of people who are like, I'm so exceptional. How? Well, learning a foreign language is exceptionally hard for me. You gotta be kidding me. I mean, you try to make yourself so exceptional because how hard it is for you, and my personal life circumstances are so exceptionally difficult. You didn't have parents like me. You didn't have no parents like me. You didn't have poverty like me. You didn't have sickness like me. Oh yeah, I can find somebody with almost exactly your circumstance. Almost exactly your circumstance who went on and kicked it. But in life, okay, I know there's somebody like that. I am not saying your circumstance wasn't hard. That I'm not saying. There's a huge difference between me saying, I know somebody is out there who had a circumstance almost exactly like yours and crushed it, and me saying, that circumstance is no big deal. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that oftentimes, studies show that that circumstance is the reason that the person who crushed it in life, crushed it in life. They wouldn't have been forced to make the decisions that they made when they look back upon, which put them in that circumstance to have the success. One person uses a reason to fail. Another uses a reason to succeed. In my business, competition sometimes scares people in business. Okay? My attitude about competition is totally not that. It is like, I don't really think much about it. What I do is I say, we're going to be exceptional. We have to be smart about competition so we're not dumb about, you know, advanced technologies and things like that. But if we outwork them, we're going to win. But in the advertising business, in magazines. We started a magazine company in 2007. This is when, you know, everybody said print is dead. I actually had a colleague come up to me and say, what are you going to do next? Start a VCR company? I mean, what is, you know, a magazine company in 2007? But we recognized there was something missing in the industry and people were leaving print. They were all thought they were going to face to snap to Instagram themselves all the way to local business heaven, and it just didn't work. Local digital left people kind of at the altar. So we recognize this and we went in to do something. But when you have magazines, you know, a lot of the people that were running magazines in the local area were afraid of competition or not. And I remember saying to one guy, I said, tell me why you're doing so well. You're crushing it. I said, well, the reason we're doing so well is there's 14 other magazines right in our area. So people love magazines and there's all sorts of advertisers. And we even look at those magazines to see what advertisers we can get. So we kind of have a little bit of an unfair advantage. This other person was not doing well. I said, why do you think you're not doing well? Well, there's 15 competitive magazines right in my area. So the competition is too hard. Literally the exact same thing. In fact, as I remember now, the person who said it was going well had 17 competitive magazines. The person who said it wasn't going well had 14. In one particular area, Chillicothe, Ohio. Are you familiar with Chillicothe, Ohio, where all the rich and famous vacation? That is not where they vacation. Chillicothe, Ohio has an unemployment rate that was, at least at the time that this took place a few years ago, was like 24%. The average income was like 24% less than the average income. It was unbelievable. And the average home value there was something like one-fifth of what the average home value was in the rest of the magazines that we put everywhere else. You know, like if we have a magazine in Jupiter Island where the average home is like, you know, a couple million dollars, the average home value there was $102,000. Okay, very impoverished area. We hired somebody to open up a magazine there, and they made one sale, and then they quit 3 weeks later, and they said, you can't do it here. There's too much poverty. It does not work here. And they were emphatic. And I know that if they ever went to visit their neighbors and have a glass of wine at the end of the day and say, I'm trying to start this business here in Chillicothe, Ohio, all their neighbors would have agreed, you can't do it here. You can't do it. This is Chillicothe, Ohio. This is not, you know, Naples, Florida. She left, a guy came in. He broke the record for sales in 7 days in the company, and for a year and a half, crushed everybody else. He sold more than every wealthy area, period, because all he saw was do the activity and get the result. This matters in life like you wouldn't believe. She was 100% without question objectively wrong. And she was 100% without question convinced she was right. There is no convincing her. Okay? And she had what it takes. We wanted to work with her. But she took herself out of the game because she psyched herself out. Do not psych yourself out on how great you can be.
Thanks for tuning into the segment. We'll be right back with our Q&A segment here at the Dave Duran Show. Welcome back to the Dave Duran Show. We have some questions lined up from our guests. Again, a quick reminder for you all, if you're interested in hearing what Dave has to say on specific questions regarding leadership, entrepreneurship, personal development, go ahead and send those over to Dave. To Dave at leadinggiants.com. Dave, the question that came in, they ask, Dear Dave, I hear you make references to hangups. What is a hangup and how does it get in the way?
Oh, yeah, this is a really good question. So, a hangup is, I mean, this is my own definition, by the way. Okay, so this is something that we kind of ran through the veins of the organizations that I've built. A hangup is something that is intellectually, feasible. It makes sense, but it's completely wrong. So for example, in sales, somebody might have a hang up like, companies don't want to pay for a long-term contract. They want to pay a short-term contract, or companies don't want to provide a credit card for automatic billing. They want you to bill them because then they can pay late on the float. If you don't know what that means, that's what a lot of companies do. And this is, it makes intellectual sense. Oftentimes it comes from the fact that they had a previous experience like that. But in the new business, it's not at all true. Or it's only true because they believe it's true. So I'm going to give you a couple examples of this. One of the companies that I started, nobody had long-term contracts ever. They just didn't do it. They were all short-term contracts and nobody paid with a credit card. They all were, you know, monthly billed. And we said, no, 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 we're not going to do that. We're going to make this simple. We're going to automate the business. And so we just constantly suggested it. And we stopped suggesting anything else. Manifest reality came out there. And when I say nobody was doing this, I mean, nobody in the industry of advertising, the way we were advertising or we're, you know, bringing on advertisers did this at all. And it completely transformed. I had one guy who was in advertising, sales and local media for 10 years. And he was very good at it. And he said, just so you know, I've done this for 10 years now. No one's going to do that. They'll never do it. And I was showing him how, look at our company's statistics. You know, it's happening everywhere. And yet we were a younger organization at the time and he had a lot of experience. So he was kind of trying to use his experience to call us lucky for a little bit, but it's not going to go that way. So I hired somebody in the market literally right adjacent to him, who had zero experience selling advertising. And she had a 100% credit card collection ratio. And all I did was show it to him. And within 30 days, he converted everybody from check monthly to credit cards. We had a hang up. It was an intellectual thing. Why? Because he experienced this before. It was rational and reasonable. It wasn't like some crazy cockamamie idea. That's what makes it hard to get past hang ups, is they're reasonable. So somebody might have a hang up about their boss. Why? Because their previous boss said something that was similar to this new boss and it didn't end up being true. So they have the life lesson that when somebody says this, they don't mean it. Well, that's rational. That makes sense. But it is probably, in this particular circumstance, entirely wrong. So when we have hangups, they hold us back. We have to literally stop and say, what's true about this situation? So when I talk about prudence all the time, prudence is the actual mechanism to get past hangups. Prudence is the mastery of decision making. It requires desiring what is good for a circumstance, knowing what is real about the circumstance, and that's how somebody overcomes this. So I would just ask you, what are your hangups? You know, the things that you're, you know, others around you say, why are you so hung up on that? You might have something in there that you're hanging on to because of the intellectual reasonability about it, even though it just absolutely does not match the circumstance. And you want to break yourself free from that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I feel like a lot of our limiting beliefs oftentimes prevent us. And you say this very frequently, and I appreciate you saying this. You can be right to your own demise or wrong to your own prosperity.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You know, and you want to celebrate in your organization. Hey, let's not be the type of organization where everybody wants to be right to their own demise as opposed to wrong to their own prosperity. And don't hang on to things just for the sake of being right. It's a bad idea.
Well, this question comes from Robert. He asks, Dear Dave, you said one time at a seminar that if entrepreneurs knew how much money was out there, they would stop fearing the ability to grow their businesses. What do you mean by that?
Okay, this is a really good point. Now, I'm not sure how many people this is going to reach that are entrepreneurs that are listening right now, but those that it does reach, it's going to free them. So, what happens is somebody gets accustomed to the average order size that they generally have for a product. And if they go above that, they get a little nervous, like, okay, you're selling a product that normally costs $1,000. And you routinely get people saying, you know, that's too expensive, because that's a part of anything that anybody's selling, no matter what price it is. So now you've got this really big client. They need a lot of what it is that you have to offer. It's the biggest opportunity ever. But because you're so used to that thousand number and some people saying it's too expensive, you go in there and you're kind of like, well, we could maybe sell you two of them for, I know it's a lot, 2,000. And they're automatically thinking something's wrong here. This person lacks so much conviction that there's something wrong with the product. And that is what causes the hesitation, because they probably went back after the meeting and said, we were willing to spend $50,000. I don't know why they were so worried about $2,000. What we do is bigger than that. And this is a very real thing. I've seen it in fundraising too, where people are trying to build a business or a fund, and they ask for something that is so little it doesn't attract people, as opposed to something more. And there is a ton of money out there. I've said this before, that I have never lost a Super Bowl. I have never lost a $10 million bet. Uh-huh. Of course, I've never been in the Super Bowl, and I've never made a $10 million bet. The things that we don't try to do, we've not failed at, and we will also never actually achieve. So when you see somebody that builds a massive company, they did things that most people that didn't build a massive company did. And they think differently. So when you're going out there and you're thinking about a product or an idea, for example, if you are a media company is a great example, and you think, wow, you know, if I did sell a contract for $1,000 a month for 12 months, that's $12,000. That's a lot of money for like a small business. Well, yeah, for some small businesses, it's an enormous amount. But actually, for most small businesses that are viable or successful or a medium-sized company, this is how it works out. If you have $1 million in revenue, which is a relatively small company, okay? I mean, it's actually a quite small company. Just because there are many companies smaller doesn't mean it's not still a very small company, okay? So if you have $1 million in revenue, you should be spending in a conservative mode 5 to 8% of your revenue on advertising, okay? So on $1 million company, you're talking about $50,000 to $80,000 on advertising. In some high growth businesses, they're going to spend 25% on advertising. That's $250,000. Now, if you're in a local market, there may not be too many advertising choices that are actually out there. And their budget is between $50,000 and $250,000. Your $12,000 doesn't even meet a small portion of the lowest level of that. But you're not thinking of it that way. You're just thinking, wow, that's $1,000 a month. And in my little small business, if you have a small advertising business, you might think, that $1,000 a month is going to affect my car payment or my house payment. So it must be the same for them too. No, it may not be. That person could be in a completely different... Now, it could be, that I know. But if it is, you're not going to get very far anyway. So that's fine. But if it isn't, you're basically talking yourself out of the sale because you're thinking with such restrictions about what is out there. But economies are massive. I mean, if you were to take the actual local economy and how many hundreds of businesses, if not thousands of businesses, would be viable customers for so many different types of businesses with tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars worth of viable revenue running through the veins of even, you know, smaller market areas that would buy certain products. So just don't limit yourself by that, thinking, you know, if your challenge, and I've been there, I know this challenge. My challenge, I mean, when I was a young man starting businesses with a young family, I was like, man, I can't fill my gas tank. I'm going to have to put like $12 worth of gas in my tank until I can build my business to the point where I can actually earn something more and then go further. But if you are on that day where a bill came in that you didn't expect and a credit card thing came in and a health payment and you could only fill your tank halfway, and you walk into your next appointment with that mentality and that sort of apology, I'm really sorry, this is really expensive, I know everybody's on hard times, that may not be the case for them, but you've now created an objection that didn't previously exist.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, I've definitely been there myself, Dave. It's funny because I remember reading this article back in 2021. I just pulled it up here. Google had $135 billion worth of cash sitting because they had nowhere to deploy that cash. Mm-hmm. $135 billion. Mm-hmm. And there just weren't enough business ideas that they wanted to, you know, deploy that cash into, or whatever the case was for them. But that's just one of many businesses. And of course, you know, you're not dealing with billion-dollar businesses at a local level, more than likely. But at the same time, it gives you a good, you know, a good idea of what cash is really out there waiting to be deployed.
Yeah, yeah. And these types of statements are important to clarify that nobody is saying everyone has all of that cash. That's not the case. But if you walk in with the assumption that times are hard, things are hard, cash is bad, or is difficult to come by, your business has a product that adds such little value, this would be an incredible burden, you know, a huge burden to the customer. No. How about, hey, one of the ways your business is going to be better and you're going to have access to more cash cash is to actually buy the product or service that we offer, which will make you more efficient or better or whatever it happens to be, and to boldly go after it that way. I mean, assuming that's true, I mean, if you're selling a junky product, get out of the industry, okay, or get out of the business and go sell something that adds value so you can have confidence in what you're talking about.
That's a great point, Dave. Well, remember to send your questions over to Dave at leadinggiants.com for next week's Q&A segment. We appreciate you all tuning in to the Dave Duran Show this week here on Relevant Radio. We will see you all next week. God bless.